The transport shuddered as it made planetfall, rattling my teeth and sending my stomach lurching into my throat. I gripped the cold metal bench beneath me, knuckles white, surrounded by the silent forms of fellow conscripts from Morton. Our agricultural world had seemed harsh once, the endless fields, the back-breaking labor, the occasional drought. Now those memories felt like paradise lost. Vrax Prime, even the name tasted like ash on my tongue. For over a decade, Imperial Guard regiments had been grinding themselves to dust against the heretic fortifications. The Adeptus Munitorum had a simple solution to the horrific attrition rate: more bodies, bodies like mine, the 88th Morton Riflemen. The designation meant nothing. We were just the latest shipment of flesh to feed the war machine. When the transport doors finally opened, the reality of Vrax assaulted my senses. The air itself was poison, a yellowish miasma that burned the lungs and stung the eyes. Veterans moved through it with practiced indifference, their faces obscured by rebreathers and respirators. Those of us fresh from the transport ships fumbled with our issued gear, struggling to seal our masks properly as the caustic atmosphere made our eyes water. I followed the shuffling column of replacement troops toward the forward trenches. The ground beneath my boots wasn't soil, it was a slurry of mud, spent casings, and things I refused to examine too closely. Bone fragments, teeth, pieces of flak armor with strips of meat still attached. The forward command post was a reinforced bunker, half sunken into the blasted landscape. Inside, an officer with dead eyes and a mechanical voice processed us with assembly line efficiency. Name, planet of origin, basic training assessment, squad assignment. The bureaucracy of death, administered with the same detached precision as the agricultural quotas back on Morton. I was assigned to Squad Tertius, 5th Platoon under Sergeant Cask. The processing officer didn't look up as he stamped my documentation, merely informing me that my expected survival duration was 23 days, slightly above average for conscripts from agricultural worlds. The Imperium's statistical efficiency was almost admirable in its cold brutality. The trenches stretched in endless zigzagging patterns across the blasted plains of Vrax. Not the neat, orderly defensive works I'd seen in Adeptus Munitorum propaganda pics, but ragged wounds in the earth, shored up with whatever materials could be salvaged, sandbags, rockcrete slabs, the occasional tank hull, and frequently the frozen corpses of the fallen, stacked like macabre building materials. The smell penetrated even through my respirator filters. Death and decay overlaid with the chemical tang of weapons discharge and the acrid burn of promethium. My new home. Sergeant Cask found me at the replacement assembly point. He was tall and gaunt, with the hollow-eyed look of a man who had seen too much to ever sleep properly again. 3 years in the Vrax trenches had whittled away everything but the essential core of him, a walking weapon forged in the crucible of endless siege warfare. His respirator hung around his neck, and I noticed the tissue around his nostrils was scarred and discolored from chemical exposure. The veterans developed a tolerance, it seemed, though at obvious cost. Cask assessed me with a single glance, noting my clean uniform, unblemished equipment, and the fear I couldn't quite hide. Without speaking, he turned and walked down the trench, expecting me to follow. I did. Squad Tertius occupied a section of forward trench approximately 30 meters long, reinforced with prefabricated ferrocrete barriers and heavy weapons emplacements. 8 men remained of what should have been a 12-man squad. Their faces showed varying degrees of the same weathered hardness as Cask's, men who had survived long past their statistical expiration date through some combination of skill, brutality, and luck. Trooper Varn cleaned a las rifle with mechanical precision, his fingers blackened with carbon residue. Beside him, Trooper Holt tended to a festering wound on his leg, applying a meager amount of antiseptic ointment before rewrapping it with a bandage that had clearly been used several times before. Trooper Ment stared blankly at the trench wall, his eyes unfocused, scratching obsessively at a patch of skin on his wrist until it bled. The others, Larn, Grist, Fennec, and Drav, huddled around a small heater unit, sharing a canteen of something that wasn't standard issue water. None of them acknowledged my arrival beyond the briefest of glances. I was just the latest replacement, not worth investing in until I proved I could survive more than a few days. Cask pointed to an empty space beside a firing step, where a bedroll stained with substances I didn't want to identify lay crumpled. My assigned position, previously occupied by a man whose name no one bothered to mention. I stowed my meager kit and tried to settle in, though settling seemed an absurd concept in this hellscape. The first artillery barrage came at dusk. No warning, just the distant whistle of shells, and then the world exploded into noise and pressure. I flattened myself against the trench floor, hands over my helmet, while the veterans merely hunched their shoulders and continued whatever they were doing. The bombardment lasted 17 minutes by my chronometer, though it felt like hours. When it ended, Cass kicked my boot and gestured for me to take position at the firing step. Watch rotation. 4 hours of staring into the chemical fog, watching for movement from the enemy lines. The landscape between the trenches, no man's land, was a nightmarish tableau of craters, tangles of razor wire, and corpses in various states of decomposition. Some had been there so long they were mummified by the toxic atmosphere, frozen in their final moments of agony. My first night on Vrax passed in a haze of terror and exhaustion. Sleep, when it came during my off-watch hours, was fitful and haunted by the constant background of distant artillery and the occasional scream from somewhere down the trench line. The ground itself seemed to vibrate with the unending war, as if the planet was in pain. Morning brought no relief, just a slight lightening of the poisonous fog. With daylight came the orders we'd all been dreading, offensive action. The 88th Morton Riflemen, along with elements of the 112th Krieg Death Corps and the 17th Vanaheim Heavy Infantry, would attempt to take Redoubt 34A, a heretic fortification that had repulsed 17 previous assaults. Preparation was minimal. Check weapons, secure equipment, consume nutrient rations, receive blessing from the regimental priest. The veterans went through the motions with grim efficiency. I copied them as best I could, hands trembling as I slotted a fresh power pack into my last rifle. Cask moved down the line, inspecting each of us. When he reached me, he paused, adjusting the straps on my flak armor and tightening the seal on my respirator. His eyes held no compassion, but there was a flicker of something, perhaps recognition of his own past fear in my face. He slapped my shoulder pad twice, a gesture that seemed to be his version of encouragement before moving on. The whistles blew at precisely 900 hours, up and over the top, the moment every guardsman dreaded. I scrambled up the ladder, boots slipping in the mud, and then I was running across no man's land, one of thousands of Imperial guardsmen charging toward the enemy fortifications. The fog limited visibility to about 50 meters, which was both blessing and curse. We couldn't see the enemy clearly, but they couldn't target us precisely either. That changed when we hit the first line of razor wire. Suddenly, the air was filled with tracer fire as heavy stubbers opened up from concealed positions. Men fell around me, some cut nearly in half by the concentrated fire. I dropped to my stomach, crawling forward beneath the worst of the barrage, using the bodies of my fallen comrades as shields. The sound was overwhelming, the crack of Law's weapons, the heavier thump of stubbers, the screams of the wounded, and the constant bellowing of sergeants trying to maintain some semblance of order in the chaos. Through it all, I could hear the distinct reports of bolt pistols from behind our lines, commissars executing those who faltered or tried to retreat. I reached the razor wire and began cutting through with the issued clippers, hands shaking so badly I could barely operate them. Somewhere to my left, a demolition charge detonated, clearing a path through the obstacle. I abandoned my efforts and scrambled toward the gap, joining a surging mass of guardsmen pushing through the breach. The next 100 meters were a blur of motion and terror. Running, diving for cover, firing blindly toward muzzle flashes in the fog. The ground shook as Imperial artillery attempted to provide covering fire, shells whistling overhead to impact against the redoubt's outer walls. More often than not, they fell short, shredding our own advancing troops in sprays of shrapnel and viscera. I found myself in a shell crater with three other guardsmen, Trooper Larn from my squad, and two I didn't recognize from another unit. One was missing his left arm below the elbow, the ragged stump cauterized by Law's fire. He stared at it with detached curiosity, as if it belonged to someone else. Shock, probably. He wouldn't last long without medical attention. Larn peered over the crater's edge, assessing the situation. The redoubt loomed ahead, a brutal slab of ferrocrete bristling with weapons emplacements. We'd advanced perhaps halfway across no man's land, but the heaviest defenses were still ahead. The attack was losing momentum as more and more troops were cut down or took cover. A series of sharp whistles cut through the din, the signal to push forward again. Larn muttered something I couldn't hear over the noise but was clearly profane, then tensed to rise. I prepared to follow, gathering my courage. We never made it out of the crater. A shell, imperial or heretic, it hardly mattered, impacted nearby, showering us with dirt and fragments. When my vision cleared, Larn and the wounded man were unrecognizable masses of torn flesh. The third guardsman screamed, his legs gone below the knees. I tried to help him, fumbling for the field dressing in my kit, but another explosion rocked the crater and something struck my helmet with tremendous force. I awoke hours later in a forward aid station, one of hundreds of wounded laid out in rows. The Medicaid moved among us with mechanical efficiency, triaging cases with cold calculus. Those who could be quickly patched and returned to duty were prioritized. Those requiring extensive treatment but likely to recover were evacuated to field hospitals further back. Those too badly wounded to be worth the resources were given Emperor's Mercy, a lethal dose of painkillers, or simply left to die. My injuries were deemed minor, a concussion and shrapnel wounds to my left shoulder and back. A Medicaid servitor cleaned and dressed the wounds with perfunctory haste, injected me with stims and antibiotics, then marked me for return to duty. 6 hours after being carried from the battlefield, I was walking back to the trenches, still dizzy and nauseous from the concussion. The assault on Redoubt 34 had failed. Like the 17 attempts before it, the attack had broken against the heretic defenses. Of the approximately 4,000 guardsmen who had gone over the top that morning, fewer than 900 returned. Squad Tertius had been reduced from 8 men to 5. Besides Larn, Trooper Grist had been killed by stubber fire in the first minutes of the assault, and Trooper Fennec was listed as missing, presumed dead. When I returned to our section of trench, Sergeant Kask merely nodded, pointing to my position on the firing step. No questions about what happened, no acknowledgement of the failed assault or our losses, just the expectation that I would take my place and continue the endless vigil. That night, the trench foot began. Despite the supposedly waterproof boots issued to us, the constant immersion in the toxic mud of Vrax had consequences. My feet burned and itched inside my boots, the skin softening and breaking down. I'd seen the progression in others, first discomfort, then pain, then the blackening of tissue as gangrene set in. The Medicaid had limited treatments, usually amputation once the infection progressed too far. Trooper Holt showed me how the veterans managed it, changing socks whenever possible, applying a mixture of promethium and medicinal unguents to toughen the skin, elevating the feet during sleep periods. It wouldn't prevent the condition, he explained, but it might slow it enough to keep me combat effective. The casual way he discussed the slow destruction of our bodies revealed more about life on Vrax than any tactical briefing could have. As I tried to sleep that night, the reality of my situation settled over me like the toxic fog. The Adeptus Munitorum had calculated my expected survival at 23 days. I had already used one of them. The statistical odds said I would die on this emperor-forsaken world, my body becoming part of the mud that future guardsmen would slog through. Just another component in the vast meat grinder that was the Siege of Vrax. The only question was whether I would die quickly, like Larn and Grist, or slowly, consumed by the trenches themselves, by disease, by chemical exposure, by the gradual erosion of sanity that I could already see in the 1,000-yard stares of the veterans. In the darkness, I clutched my last rifle and tried not to think about the next assault, which would inevitably come. The Imperium had unlimited resources, not in weapons or equipment, but in human lives. We would keep attacking until the position fell or every last one of us was dead. That was the calculus of Imperial warfare. That was Vrax. 3 days after the failed assault on Redoubt 34A, Sergeant Kask gestured toward me during evening ration distribution. His weathered face betrayed nothing as he pointed to three other men, Varn, Drav, and a replacement named Thull who'd arrived yesterday. Night patrol. The word sent ice through my veins. No man's land after dark was a death sentence. Even the veterans feared it. We prepared in silence, blackening exposed skin and equipment with soot from the heating unit. Varn, a lean man with a scar bisecting his left eyebrow, checked my gear with practiced efficiency, tightening straps that might rattle and wrapping cloth around my canteen to muffle any sound. His hands moved with mechanical precision, having performed this ritual countless times. How he'd survived this long seemed miraculous. The toxic twilight faded to absolute darkness as we waited for the appointed hour. Flares occasionally illuminated the hellscape beyond our trench, casting long shadows across the corpse-strewn wasteland. In those brief moments of light, I glimpsed the twisted terrain we would navigate, shell craters filled with stagnant chemical runoff, tangles of razor wire, and the grotesque silhouettes of the dead in various poses of agony. Varn led us out at 2300 hours, slipping over the trench lip with serpentine grace. I followed, my heart hammering so loudly I feared the enemy would hear it. The ground beneath my belly was a slurry of mud, spent casings, and decomposing matter I refused to contemplate. The stench penetrated even my respirator, the sweet-sour reek of putrefaction overlaid with chemical burn. We crawled forward meter by agonizing meter. A searchlight from the enemy lines swept across no man's land, and we froze, pressing ourselves into the muck as the beam passed overhead. 30 seconds of absolute stillness, not even daring to breathe. When darkness returned, we continued our advance. The first corpse I crawled over had been there so long it had partially fused with the ground. The toxic environment of Vrax preserved dead flesh in strange ways, mummifying some bodies while liquefying others. This one's face remained intact enough to see the horror frozen on its features, jaw stretched wide in a silent scream. The insignia on the rotted uniform marked him as 112th Krieg. How many assaults ago had he fallen? How many layers of dead did the soil of Vrax contain? We reached our first objective, a large shell crater approximately 200 meters into no man's land. Varn signaled for us to take observation positions around its rim. From here, we could monitor movement near the enemy lines while remaining relatively concealed. Our mission was simple: gather intelligence on enemy positions, note any changes in their defensive arrangements, and return before dawn. Simple, but far from easy. Hours crawled by as we maintained our vigil. Occasional flares and distant firefights briefly illuminated sections of the battlefield, revealing glimpses of the enemy fortifications. I focused my magnoculars on their forward trench line, noting the positions of heavy weapons emplacements. Something about their arrangement had changed since the last assault. They'd shifted their stubborn nests, creating overlapping fields of fire that would chew through our ranks even more efficiently next time. Movement caught my eye, a patrol emerging from the enemy trench, 5 figures moving with unnatural precision through their own wire. Varn had seen them too, signaling for absolute stillness. We were downwind, our scent carried away from them, but any movement might catch their attention. The enemy patrol moved closer, following a path that would take them within 20 meters of our position. As they passed beneath a momentary flare, I got my first clear look at our adversaries and my blood froze. These were not ordinary heretics. Their forms were wrong, hunched, and asymmetrical, with crude augmetic components jutting from flesh. One had replaced his entire lower jaw with a mechanical apparatus that clicked and whirred as he scanned the darkness. Another moved on legs bent backward like a canid's, mechanical pistons visible through torn fatigues. Their armor was a patchwork of standard imperial flak plate and custom fabrications of unknown origin, adorned with symbols that hurt my eyes to look upon. Dark Mechanicum influence. The rumors were true. These weren't just rebels, they were in league with tech heretics, their bodies modified with forbidden augmetics. Self-mutilation as devotion to their dark gods. The patrol passed without detecting us, disappearing into the chemical fog toward another section of no man's land. We remained frozen for 10 minutes afterward, ensuring they were truly gone before continuing our mission. Varn signaled for us to advance further toward the enemy wire, a risky move but necessary to gather more detailed intelligence. We slithered forward through the muck, using corpses and debris as cover. A sniper round cracked past my head so close I felt its passage disturb the air. Someone had spotted movement. We froze again, becoming part of the battlefield's detritus. Minutes passed, no further shots. We continued our advance with even greater caution. Near the enemy wire, we found something that turned my stomach. A body, one of ours, a guardsman from the recent assault. Unlike the other corpses, this one showed evidence of having been dragged here deliberately. The wounds were not from combat. Precise incisions marked the torso and limbs, with the chest cavity splayed open and partially emptied. Surgical tubing protruded from the severed arteries, and crude augmetic components had been grafted to the exposed spine. They were experimenting on our dead. No, not just our dead. The lack of blood pooling suggested these procedures had been performed while the victim still lived. Drav made a notation in his data slate, documenting the discovery with the clinical detachment of a man whose horror threshold had long since been exceeded. Varn took picked captures with a small device, evidence for command. I simply stared, trying to process what I was seeing. The corpse's eyes had been replaced with augmetic lenses that still glowed with a faint red light despite the host's death. Power cells implanted in the chest cavity continued to function, driving whatever abominable purpose these modifications served. Most disturbing of all, the victim's brain had been partially exposed and fitted with metallic probes that disappeared into the gray matter. What information had they extracted? What secrets had they torn from this soldier's mind? We found more evidence as we continued our survey of the enemy perimeter, drag marks leading back to their lines. Collection points where bodies had been sorted, some discarded, others taken. A small field of stakes where particularly interesting specimens had been displayed, modified in various ways as if the enemy were conducting public demonstrations of their work. Through my magnoculars, I observed activity behind the enemy front line, the silhouettes of large structures that hadn't appeared on our intelligence briefings. Bunker complexes, partially concealed by camouflage netting. Loading bays where covered transports arrived and departed according to some schedule. The scale suggested an operation far beyond simple battlefield survival. They were manufacturing something here, using our dead and captured as raw materials. A distant explosion lit up the sky to the north, another Imperial assault failing against a different section of the line. The distraction gave us cover to withdraw, crawling back the way we had come with our grim intelligence. The return journey felt longer, each meter a struggle against exhaustion and horror. Dawn was approaching as we slipped back into our trench. Sergeant Kask waited, his expression unchanging as Varn delivered his report in hushed tones. The data slate and picked captures were handed over, evidence that would make its way up the chain of command, perhaps all the way to regimental headquarters. Whether it would change anything remained to be seen. The Imperium's war machine rarely altered its course based on the suffering of individual soldiers. The next day brought new tension to the trench. Word of what we discovered spread quickly, despite official attempts to control the information. Guardsmen spoke in whispers about the enemy's experiments, about comrades captured rather than killed outright. Each distant scream from no man's land now carried new significance. Was it a wounded man dying or something worse? Paranoia spread like a contagion. A sentry from the adjacent section of trench disappeared during his watch. No shots fired, no alarm raised, simply gone when his relief arrived. Equipment began to malfunction in suspicious ways, lasguns failing at critical moments, vox casters picking up interference that sounded disturbingly like mechanical breathing, ration packs found partially consumed by something that left chemical burns on the packaging. The veterans grew watchful, suspicious of the replacements who continued to arrive daily. Fresh-faced men from distant worlds, any of whom might be, compromised. I caught Trooper Mentz staring at me during meal distribution, his eyes narrowed as if trying to determine whether I was still fully human. The irony wasn't lost on me. His own exposure to Vrax had left him with nervous tics and patches of discolored skin that made him look more inhuman than any of the newcomers. Suspicion turned to violence 5 days after our patrol. Two squads from the adjacent trench section accused each other of harboring infiltrators. The confrontation escalated from threats to drawn weapons. A commissar intervened, executing the primary agitators with his bolt pistol, but the damage was done. Trust, already in short supply on Vrax, had eroded further. That night I discovered something that confirmed our worst fears. Assigned to check the ammunition cache behind our position, I found evidence of systematic sabotage. Lasgun power packs had been drained to near empty, their seals carefully replaced to hide the tampering. Grenades had been subtly modified, their detonation mechanisms compromised. Someone within our lines was ensuring our weapons would fail when needed most. I reported the discovery to Sergeant Kask, who inspected the cache himself before sealing it and posting a guard. His face betrayed nothing, but the tension in his shoulders spoke volumes. The enemy wasn't just beyond the wire, they were among us. The artillery began at midnight. Not the usual harassment fire, but a concentrated barrage that walked methodically across our trench line. The ground bucked and heaved beneath me as I pressed myself into a reinforced corner of the trench, helmet covered with my arms. Soil and shrapnel rained down, burying men alive in collapsed sections. The medicay stations were quickly overwhelmed with casualties. The barrage continued for hours, pinning us down and preventing any coordinated response. When a shell collapsed the section of trench to my right, I found myself cut off from the rest of the squad. Choking on dust and propellant residue, I crawled through the debris, seeking any intact position. What I found was an abandoned bunker, partially collapsed, but still offering shelter from the bombardment. I squeezed through a gap in the ferrocrete, dropping into a space that hadn't seen human occupation in months, possibly years. The air was stale but less toxic than outside, allowing me to briefly lift my respirator and wipe the grime from my face. The bunker had once served as an officer's command post, evident from the remains of Vox equipment and tactical displays. Most had been salvaged or destroyed during a previous withdrawal, but a few items remained, including a locked data storage unit that had fallen behind a collapsed section of shelving. The bombardment continued overhead as I examined the find. The lock was standard Imperial issue, and I managed to bypass it using techniques I'd learned during basic training. Inside were data slates and picked recordings, forgotten or deliberately hidden during a hasty evacuation. What they contained shook me to my core. Picked recordings of Imperial officers, men wearing the insignia of not just the guard regiments on Vrax, but also representatives from the Adeptus Munitorum and even the Commissariat, meeting with figures who could only be enemy leaders. The recordings were date-stamped from 2 years earlier, well into the current conflict. The meetings appeared to be negotiations, though no audio accompanied the images. Maps were exchanged, documents signed. In one recording, an Imperial colonel handed over what appeared to be a data slate to a robed figure whose mechanical augmentations marked him as a tech priest, but one whose modifications had strayed far from orthodox Mechanicus patterns. Collaboration, conspiracy, the implications were staggering. The war on Vrax, the meat grinder that had consumed millions of Imperial lives, might not be what we had been told. Some element of Imperial leadership was working with the enemy, extending the conflict for purposes I couldn't begin to fathom. I secured the data storage unit in my pack as the bombardment finally began to slacken. Whatever I had discovered, it needed to reach someone who could act on it, though who that might be, I had no idea. In an environment where anyone might be compromised, who could be trusted with such information? The gap through which I'd entered the bunker had been partially blocked by debris from a near hit. I dug my way out, emerging into a landscape transformed by the barrage. Entire sections of our trench system had been obliterated, replaced by overlapping craters filled with toxic runoff and broken bodies. The chemical fog had thickened, visibility reduced to mere meters. Movement caught my eye, figures advancing through the fog from the direction of the enemy lines. The distinctive hunched silhouettes and mechanical movements identified them immediately as the augmented enemy we'd observed on patrol. They moved with purpose, checking bodies, collecting some, dispatching wounded with precise shots to the head. I froze in place, half buried in debris, as a patrol passed within meters of my position. Their augmetic eyes swept the battlefield, seeking survivors. One paused, sensor arrays on its modified helm swiveling in my direction. For a moment I was certain I'd been detected. Then artillery began falling again, our guns this time, responding to the enemy advance, and the patrol moved on, seeking cover. I remained motionless long after they passed, the weight of what I'd discovered pressing down on me more heavily than the rubble that partially concealed me. The enemy beyond the wire was horrific enough, twisted reflections of humanity, corrupted by forbidden technology. But the enemy within our own ranks, the betrayal suggested by those picked recordings, represented a horror of a different magnitude. As I finally extracted myself from the debris and began making my way back toward what remained of our lines, a terrible thought occurred to me. The Adeptus Munitorum had calculated my expected survival at 23 days. What if that wasn't a statistical estimate, but a scheduled termination? What if the entire war on Vrax was nothing but an elaborate processing facility, converting human soldiers into raw materials for some darker purpose? The thought was paranoid, irrational, and yet after what I'd seen, I could no longer dismiss it entirely. The meat grinder of Vrax suddenly seemed even more sinister, a machine designed not just to kill, but to transform. And I was caught within its gears, being processed for purposes I was only beginning to glimpse. I rejoined what remained of my unit 3 days after the bombardment. The survivors had consolidated into a makeshift defensive position around a partially intact command bunker. Sergeant Kask nodded at my return, making a tally mark on his data slate, one more body still capable of firing a las gun. The data storage unit weighed heavily in my pack, its secrets temporarily forgotten as more immediate concerns took precedence. The bombardment had achieved its purpose. Our lines were broken, defensive positions compromised. Command saw opportunity in disaster. The enemy had expended significant ordnance and would be regrouping. A counterattack could exploit temporary weaknesses in their defenses. The assault order came down at dawn. My unit, along with elements of three other depleted companies, would push forward through the breach created by the bombardment. Our objective, Redoubt 37C, a forward command post that intelligence suggested was lightly defended. A rare chance for a breakthrough in the stalemate of Vrax. We moved out under cover of our own artillery barrage, advancing through cratered terrain that bore little resemblance to the trench lines I'd become accustomed to. The chemical fog provided concealment, though it meant we relied on compass bearings and distance calculations rather than visual navigation. The veteran troopers moved with practiced efficiency, using the terrain for cover while maintaining formation. The first resistance we encountered was light, scattered fire from retreating pickets. We pressed forward, emboldened by their withdrawal. For once, it seemed Imperial intelligence had been accurate. The enemy was off balance, their defensive line compromised by their own bombardment success. I crested a rise and found myself looking down at Redoubt 37C. Unlike the massive fortifications we'd futilely assaulted before, this was a more modest installation, a hardened bunker complex surrounded by hastily reinforced defensive positions. Most significant was what lay behind it, a clear path to the enemy's rear areas, a genuine breakthrough opportunity. The fighting intensified as we closed on the redoubt. The defenders rallied, pouring fire from reinforced positions. I hugged the toxic earth, advancing in short bursts between craters and debris. A Laws bolt scorched past my helmet, close enough to leave a heat mark on the ceramite. I returned fire, not aiming at any specific target, but contributing to the suppressing barrage our squad was laying down. Sergeant Kask signaled for fire concentration on a heavy weapons nest that was holding up our advance. 10 LAS guns focused on the position, the combined fire eventually penetrating the armored shield and silencing the weapon. We surged forward in the gap, closing to grenade range. The next minutes passed in a blur of close quarters combat. I found myself inside the redoubt's outer perimeter, moving from cover to cover, firing at shapes that emerged from the chemical haze. Some wore the patchwork armor of the renegades, others moved with the unnatural gait of the augmented troops I'd observed earlier. A figure lunged at me from behind a collapsed wall section. I fired instinctively, the Laws bolt catching it mid-chest. It stumbled but didn't fall, mechanical limbs compensating for the damage to its biological components. I fired again, aiming for the head. The shot connected, destroying whatever remained of the human brain inside the augmented skull. The body collapsed, twitching as its mechanical systems continued to function briefly before powering down. We secured the outer perimeter within 20 minutes, converging on the central bunker complex. The defenders withdrew inside, sealing blast doors and firing from armored view slits. Demolition charges were brought up, placed at structural weak points identified by combat engineers. The resulting explosions breached the outer defenses, allowing us to penetrate deeper into the complex. What we found inside changed everything I thought I knew about our enemy. The first chamber contained holding pens, not for animals but for humans, Imperial guardsmen captured during previous actions. They were segregated by physical condition. The healthy ones were crowded into cages barely large enough to stand in. The wounded occupied medical slabs, their injuries treated but their limbs restrained. The dying were arranged on examination tables, their final moments closely monitored by recording devices. Most disturbing were those who had been modified. Men and women with crude augmetic components grafted to their bodies, their eyes vacant, movements mechanical. Many bore the scars of recent surgery, the join between flesh and machine still raw and seeping. They didn't react to our presence, didn't seem aware of their surroundings at all. I examined one more closely. The back of his skull had been opened, a metal interface plate grafted to the exposed brain tissue. Small lights pulsed on the device, indicating active function. His eyes were open but unseeing, pupils dilated to different sizes. A small metal port had been installed at the base of his neck, with tubes connecting to a reservoir of murky fluid strapped to his back. The fluid pulsed into his spinal column at regular intervals, each injection causing his muscles to spasm briefly. The insignia on his tattered uniform marked him as 44th Morton, my own regiment, likely captured during a previous assault. I checked his identification tags. Trooper Fennec, the squad member listed as missing after the failed attack on Redoubt 34A, he showed no recognition, no awareness that he stood before a former comrade. Deeper in the complex, we discovered the purpose of these modifications. A large chamber had been converted into a manufacturing floor. Conveyor systems moved bodies, some still living, through different processing stations. At each point, tech adepts in stained robes performed specific procedures. The installation of control interfaces, the grafting of augmetic limbs, the implantation of chemical dispensers. The process was industrial in scale and efficiency. These weren't the crude field modifications of desperate renegades. This was systematic production, with quality control checkpoints and specialized equipment. One section appeared dedicated to research and development, with more elaborate modifications being tested on conscious subjects whose screams had been silenced by the removal of their vocal cords. Most telling were the insignia. The tech adepts overseeing the operation wore robes bearing Mechanicus symbols, altered with subtle hereditations, but recognizably derived from the cult Mechanicus. Dark Mechanicum, operating openly within what was supposed to be a simple heretic stronghold. I moved through the facility in a daze, documenting what I saw with my helmet-picked recorder. The implications were staggering. This wasn't just a rebel outpost, it was a production facility using captured Imperial soldiers as raw material for creating combat servitors and augmented troops. The enemy we'd been fighting included our own comrades, transformed into weapons to be used against us. In a side chamber, we discovered the command center. The defenders had destroyed most of the data systems before we breached the room, but some information remained intact. Tactical displays showed the broader strategic situation, including the locations of similar facilities throughout the sector. This wasn't an isolated operation, but part of a coordinated network. Most significant was a prisoner we captured attempting to purge the remaining data systems, a robed figure whose extensive augmentations marked him as a Magos biologus. His mechanical limbs had been disabled by a well-placed Laz bolt, leaving him immobile but conscious. The insignia on his robes indicated he had once served the legitimate Mechanicus before turning renegade. Sergeant Kask ordered the prisoner secured for interrogation. Two troopers bound his remaining biological components while a combat tech priest disabled his more dangerous implants. The Magos remained silent throughout, his augmetic eyes recording everything with clinical detachment. The interrogation took place in what had been the facility's Medicaid section. The irony wasn't lost on me, using their own surgical implements to extract information. I stood guard at the entrance, close enough to hear what transpired without directly participating in the questioning. The Magos resisted initially, his mind protected by both training and mechanical augmentations designed to compartmentalize information. These defenses eroded under the combined efforts of a regiment interrogator and the combat tech priest, who understood which systems to disable to maximize the prisoner's discomfort without rendering him unconscious. What the Magos revealed confirmed our worst suspicions. Elements within the Dark Mechanicum had been using the Vrax conflict as a massive testing ground for human enhancement technologies. The prolonged siege provided perfect cover, a constant supply of test subjects, minimal oversight from distant Imperial authorities, and the chaos of war to obscure their true activities. Most disturbing was his claim that the research had originated within the Orthodox Mechanicus itself. Projects deemed too radical or heretical for official sanction had been continued in secret by tech priests who saw opportunity in the Vrax uprising. What began as unauthorized research evolved into outright heresy as they pursued knowledge without ethical constraints. The Magos spoke of optimization protocols and combat efficiency algorithms being tested on captured guardsmen. Successful modifications were replicated on a larger scale, failed experiments recycled for biological components. The casual way he described the processing of human beings revealed the fundamental inhumanity of his perspective. We were merely raw material for the advancement of his research. When questioned about Imperial collaboration, the Magos confirmed what the picked recordings I'd discovered had suggested. Certain elements within the Imperial command structure were aware of the operation. Some actively provided test subjects, ensuring that specific units were deployed in ways that maximized capture rates. Others simply looked the other way, accepting the prolonged conflict as the price of technological advancement. The interrogation was cut short by the facility's automated defense systems activating. Despite our efforts to secure the complex, hidden protocols had initiated a contingency plan. Alarm klaxons blared throughout the structure as sealed doors began to open, releasing the products that had been manufactured there. The first wave consisted of combat servitors, former guardsmen whose minds had been wiped and bodies augmented for maximum lethality. They attacked without strategy or self-preservation, simply advancing and engaging any target within reach. Their augmentations included hydraulic limbs capable of crushing flak armor, integrated weapon systems, and redundant vital systems that made them difficult to put down permanently. We fell back to defensive positions, concentrating fire on the approaching servitors. Las bolts that would have instantly killed an unmodified human merely slowed these abominations. I aimed for the control interfaces visible at the backs of their skulls, finding that destroying these systems was more effective than targeting conventional vital areas. The second wave was more sophisticated and far more disturbing. These weren't mindless servitors, but augmented troops with retained tactical awareness. They used cover, coordinated their movements, and employed ranged weapons with precision. Their augmentations were less visible but no less extensive: subdermal armor plating, enhanced sensory systems, and chemical injectors that kept them fighting through injuries that would incapacitate normal soldiers. Most horrifying was recognizing faces among the attackers. Men who had fought alongside us days earlier, captured rather than killed, now turned against their former comrades. One charged my position, and I hesitated upon recognizing Trooper Fennec. That hesitation nearly cost me my life as he fired a burst from an integrated weapon system that had replaced his right arm. The shots impacted the wall beside me, showering me with fragments as I dove for better cover. The worst came last. The facility's deepest chambers disgorged what could only be described as living weapons, human forms so extensively modified they barely resembled their original species. Explosive charges had been surgically implanted in their torsos. Chemical dispensers replaced their respiratory systems, spewing toxins that corroded armor and flesh alike. Mechanical limbs moved with unnatural speed, allowing them to close distances before defensive fire could bring them down. These were suicide troops, designed to inflict maximum damage at the cost of their own destruction. They charged our positions with no regard for survival, detonating when they reached optimal proximity. The first explosion caught a fire team in the open, the blast shredding their flak armor and the corrosive chemicals continuing to eat through survivors' flesh even after the initial detonation. We adapted quickly, establishing overlapping fields of fire to bring down the suicide troops before they could reach our positions. Concentrated Law's fire could detonate their explosive implants prematurely, turning the enemy's weapons against themselves. Still, they kept coming, wave after wave of former humans converted into disposable weapons. The battle for the facility lasted hours, a room-by-room struggle against an enemy that had once been our own. When the final modified trooper fell, we were left with the grim task of securing the complex against potential reinforcements. The surviving tech priest estimated that we had encountered only a fraction of the facility's production. The remainder had likely been deployed elsewhere on the front or evacuated before our arrival. As we established a defensive perimeter, I examined the manufacturing equipment more carefully. The scale of the operation was difficult to comprehend. Processing capacity suggested thousands of captured guardsmen had passed through this facility alone. Multiplied across the other locations indicated on the tactical displays, the number of Imperial soldiers converted into weapons could be in the hundreds of thousands. The implications extended far beyond Vrax. If elements within both the Mechanicus and Imperial command structure were complicit in these operations, similar projects could be underway throughout the Imperium. The endless meat grinder of Imperial warfare provided perfect cover. Who would notice specific regiments being sacrificed when millions died every day across countless war zones? I thought of the data storage unit still hidden in my pack, the evidence of high-level collaboration it contained. Combined with what we discovered here, it painted a picture of corruption reaching into the highest levels of imperial authority. The question remained, who could be trusted with such information? For now, that question would have to wait. Enemy forces had realized the significance of our breakthrough and were massing for a counterattack. Auspex's readings showed large formations converging on our position from multiple directions. Among them were signatures matching the modified troops we'd encountered, former comrades now weaponized against us. I checked my lasgun's power pack and took position at a firing slit overlooking the approach to the facility. The toxic fog of Vrax had thinned temporarily, giving unusual visibility across the blasted landscape. In the distance, I could see them coming, hundreds of augmented figures moving with mechanical precision, former humans transformed into components of a vast war machine. The flesh factories of Vrax had been producing for years. Now their products were returning to reclaim their manufacturing center, and we were all that stood in their way. Morning came with new orders. Sergeant Kask gathered what remained of our squad behind a collapsed section of the command bunker. His face was grim as he pointed to a tactical display showing our position relative to the front lines. The breakthrough we'd achieved by capturing the flesh factory had created a salient, a bulge in the defensive line that extended dangerously into enemy territory. Rather than reinforce our position, command had decided to use it as a diversion. The orders were simple and brutal: hold position at all costs. Draw enemy forces away from the real offensive being launched 5 kilometers to the south. No reinforcements would be coming. No evacuation was planned. We were expendable assets in a strategic deception. I scanned the faces of my fellow soldiers. The veterans understood immediately what the orders meant. We were being sacrificed. The replacements still held confused expressions, not yet grasping that our deaths had been scheduled by distant officers who would never know our names. As Kask continued the briefing, I noticed figures moving into position behind our defensive perimeter. Commissars, their long coats distinctive even through the toxic haze, taking up observation posts with clear lines of sight into our position. They weren't there to inspire us or lead the defense. They were there to ensure none of us attempted to retreat. The enemy attack began an hour later. Artillery first, as always on Vrax, the shells walking methodically across our position. We huddled in reinforced sections of the captured facility, the structure groaning under the impacts. When the barrage lifted, we moved quickly to our defensive positions, knowing what would follow. They came through the chemical fog in waves. The first rank consisted of unmodified troops, conscripts, or penal units poorly armed and unarmored. Cannon fodder to absorb our initial volleys and reveal our firing positions. Behind them came the augmented soldiers, moving with mechanical precision, their weapons integrated into modified limbs and torsos. I sighted down my las gun, picking targets methodically. Each squeeze of the trigger sent a bolt of energy into the advancing mass. Some fell. Most kept coming, their augmented bodies able to absorb damage that would kill an unmodified human. Our defensive fire thinned their ranks but couldn't stop the advance. They reached our outer perimeter 20 minutes into the attack. Close quarters combat erupted along the line, las fire, grenades, and combat knives against hydraulic limbs and integrated weapon systems. A modified trooper breached the firing slit beside me, mechanical arms punching through the reinforced material. I emptied my lasgun's charge into its center mass, the sustained fire finally overloading whatever systems kept it functioning. The first wave was repulsed, but at heavy cost. Half our defensive positions had been overrun. The survivors consolidated around the central bunker complex, establishing a tighter perimeter. Ammunition was running low. Medical supplies were exhausted. The wounded who couldn't fight were moved to a central chamber, a gesture of compassion that everyone knew was ultimately meaningless. Between attacks, Sergeant Kask approached me. His face showed no emotion as he gestured for me to follow him into a secure storage area away from the others. Inside, he revealed a hidden compartment in his field kit, extracting a data slate and several memory crystals. The evidence he'd been collecting for months, records of specific deployment orders, casualty reports, and transfer manifests showing the systematic sacrifice of certain units to the flesh factories. Kask had been investigating the corruption within our command structure since his first encounter with the modified troops 8 months ago. He'd recognized the insignia on a captured augmented soldier, a man from his original squad, reported killed in action but clearly taken for processing instead. Since then, he documented dozens of cases where units were deliberately positioned for maximum capture rates rather than tactical advantage. The sergeant's plan was desperate but not without logic. The next enemy assault would likely overwhelm our position. In the chaos, a small team might be able to slip through the lines, using the chemical fog and battlefield confusion as cover. Not to retreat, the commissars would shoot anyone moving toward our lines, but to circle around, bypassing the main enemy force to reach the Imperial positions south of the offensive. Kask believed that somewhere in the Imperial hierarchy, there must be uncorrupted officials who would act on evidence of such widespread heresy. The data he'd collected, combined with my own discoveries at the abandoned command post, might be enough to trigger an actual investigation rather than another cover-up. Five of us were selected for the escape attempt: myself, Kask, Varn, and two newer troopers named Dorn and Lentes, who had proven themselves adaptable in the fighting. The rest would maintain the defense, buying time with their lives. No one complained about the assignments, though staying behind knew their fate was sealed regardless. We prepared as best we could, distributing the remaining ammunition and supplies. The evidence was copied across multiple data devices, each of us carrying a complete set. If even one made it through, the mission could succeed. As final preparations were made, I noticed Kask speaking privately with each soldier remaining behind. Not orders or tactical instructions, he was collecting their identification tags and personal effects, promising to see they reached the proper authorities. A promise we all knew might be impossible to keep, but one that provided some small comfort. The next attack came at dusk, heralded by another artillery barrage that was noticeably less intense than previous bombardments. The enemy was conserving ammunition, confident that this assault would be the last needed to overwhelm our position. As the barrage lifted and the advancing forces emerged from the chemical fog, Kask gave the signal. We slipped out through a maintenance shaft that had been concealed during our hasty fortification of the position, emerging behind our defensive line as the main enemy force engaged our remaining troops. The sounds of combat provided cover for our movement as we crawled through the toxic mud, using debris and corpses for concealment. The plan was to circle wide around the enemy formation, using the gathering darkness and chemical fog to mask our approach. For the first half kilometer, everything proceeded as intended. We moved silently through the wasteland, navigating by compass and distance markers rather than visual landmarks. Then we encountered the first complication. A secondary enemy force was moving into position on our intended escape route, not frontline troops, but a specialized unit equipped with advanced sensor equipment. Their augmentations included enhanced visual systems that could penetrate the chemical fog, making our concealment tactics ineffective. Kask signaled for us to divert course, moving deeper into no man's land. This route would be more dangerous, taking us through areas saturated with unexploded ordnance and chemical concentrations high enough to degrade our respirator filters, but it offered our only chance of avoiding detection. We crawled through a landscape more alien than anything I could have imagined before Vrax. The constant artillery bombardments had transformed the terrain into something that barely resembled a planetary surface. Craters overlapped craters, filled with stagnant chemical pools that glowed faintly in the gathering darkness. The corpses here were different from those near the front lines, mummified by chemical exposure, preserved in grotesque poses of final agony. Our progress slowed as we navigated this nightmare terrain. Twice we were forced to remain motionless for extended periods as enemy patrols passed nearby, their augmented sensory systems sweeping the area. Each time, the toxic mud we lay in burned through our uniforms, leaving chemical burns on exposed skin. 3 hours into our escape attempt, disaster struck. An artillery shell, whether Imperial or enemy, made no difference, impacted nearby, the explosion throwing Dorn into the open and showering the rest of us with debris and chemical spray. Before we could recover, bright searchlights swept across the position. We'd been spotted. Laz fire erupted from multiple directions as hidden enemy positions revealed themselves. They'd been waiting, I realized, not patrolling randomly, but establishing a perimeter to catch anyone attempting to escape the doomed salient. Our plan had been anticipated. Kask signaled for us to scatter and continue individually. Our chances would be better separated than bunched together as a single target. I crawled away from the impact site, using the uneven terrain for cover as Law's bolts cut through the chemical fog around me. Behind me, I heard the distinctive sound of a flamer igniting, followed by screams quickly cut short. One of us had been caught. I kept moving, pushing through exhaustion and pain. My respirator filter was degrading, allowing toxic fumes to seep through with each labored breath. The chemical burns on my exposed skin had begun to blister and weep. Still, I continued, driven by the weight of the evidence I carried and the knowledge that those left behind at the defensive position were dying to give us this chance. Dawn found me huddled in a drainage culvert, half submerged in toxic runoff but hidden from immediate view. I had no idea if any of the others had survived the night. My chrono indicated I'd covered approximately 4 kilometers, still short of Imperial lines, but beyond the main enemy formations. As light filtered through the chemical fog, I took stock of my situation. My lasgun had 2 shots remaining in its power pack with no spares. My water was contaminated, the canteen having been punctured during the artillery strike. The data devices containing the evidence were intact, secured in waterproof containers within my kit. My respirator had perhaps 2 hours of effective filtration left before the chemicals would begin causing permanent lung damage. I was preparing to move out when I heard them, the distinctive sound of grav chutes deploying, followed by the impact of armored boots on hard ground, not regular infantry, but something heavier. Through a gap in the culvert's damaged covering, I caught glimpses of matte black carapace armor and specialized weaponry. Tempestus Scions, the elite special forces of the Militarum Tempestus, deployed directly behind enemy lines for high priority operations. For a moment, I felt hope. Imperial special forces could extract me, ensure the evidence reached the proper authorities. Then I saw their insignia, a modified Aquila that matched symbols in Kask's evidence files. These weren't rescuers, they were a kill team, deployed specifically to eliminate witnesses and recover compromising evidence. I remained motionless as they swept the area with advanced Auspex equipment, their helmet Vox units transmitting in encrypted bursts. Their movements were methodical, professional, checking each potential hiding place with textbook precision. They weren't searching randomly. Somehow they knew approximately where to look. One approached my culvert, the beam of his helmet-mounted luminator sweeping across the opening. I pressed myself deeper into the toxic sludge, ignoring the burning sensation as the chemicals contacted fresh wounds. The light paused, then moved on as the Scion received new instructions through his Vox. They had found someone else. I heard the distinctive crack of hellguns firing in controlled bursts, followed by the heavier sound of a bolt weapon. A voice called out, not in pain or fear, but in defiance. Sergeant Kask, facing his executioners with the same stoic determination he'd shown throughout our time on Vrax. The Scions converged on his position. Through my limited vantage point, I could see them surrounding a shallow crater where Kask had taken cover. The sergeant was wounded, his uniform torn and bloody, but he still clutched his data slate in one hand and his service pistol in the other. The Tempestor Prime, leader of the kill team, stepped forward, bolt pistol raised. What happened next occurred with such speed that I almost missed it. Kask triggered something on his data slate. The devices carried by each member of our escape team had been synchronized, designed to broadcast their contents on a specific signal. Suddenly, every Vox unit within range, including those of the Scions, was transmitting the evidence of corruption and heresy we'd gathered. The Tempestor Prime executed Kask with a bolt round to the head, but it was too late. The data was transmitting, flooding local Vox channels with evidence that couldn't be easily contained. The Scion's coordinated discipline broke as they frantically attempted to jam the transmission, their movements becoming hurried and less methodical. I used the distraction to slip away from the culvert, crawling through drainage channels that ran beneath the blasted landscape. Behind me, I could hear the Scions spreading out, resuming their search with renewed urgency. They knew at least one more witness remained alive, carrying additional evidence that could expose the corruption extending into their own ranks. My flight became a nightmarish blur of pain and exhaustion. The toxic environment of Vrax worked against both hunter and hunted, degrading equipment, limiting visibility, creating false readings on sensor equipment. I used every trick learned during my time in the trenches, moving only when artillery barrages provided acoustic cover, using corpses to mask my thermal signature, following drainage channels where the chemical concentration would interfere with Auspex readings. Allah's bolt caught me in the side as I crossed an exposed stretch of ground, the impact spinning me into a chemical pool. The wound wasn't immediately fatal, but blood loss and toxic exposure would ensure a slow death if untreated. I crawled into a mass grave, a collection pit where bodies had been gathered for processing before our assault interrupted the facility's operations. Among the dead, I found a functional Vox unit on a fallen officer, not powerful enough to reach Imperial lines, but sufficient to record and store what might be my final testament. As I activated the device, I could hear the Scions methodically quartering the area, closing in on my position. They were thorough and professional, leaving nothing to chance. Soon they would find me. With failing strength, I recorded everything: the flesh factories, the modified troops, the deliberate sacrifice of Imperial units, the collaboration between corrupt officers and dark mechanicum elements. I included names from Kask's evidence, dates of specific operations, coordinates of processing facilities. Most importantly, I detailed the involvement of elements within the Militarum Tempestus in eliminating witnesses and suppressing evidence. As I spoke, I realized the true horror of Vrax wasn't what I had initially believed. It wasn't the enemy beyond the wire, twisted though they were. It wasn't even the flesh factories with their industrial processing of human beings into weapons. The true horror was the system itself, an Imperium so vast and indifferent that millions could be sacrificed without question, where corruption could fester unchecked because human life had no intrinsic value beyond its utility as a resource. The Vox unit's power cell was failing, its transmission range limited to a few hundred meters at most. The chances of my testimony reaching anyone who would act on it were infinitesimal. Yet I continued recording, driven by the same stubborn determination that had kept me alive through 29 days on Vrax, 6 days beyond my statistically expected survival. In the distance, I could hear the Scions' methodical approach, the clicks and whirs of their Auspex equipment as they narrowed down my location. Soon they would find me among the dead, eliminate the final witness, and recover the last pieces of evidence. The corruption would continue, the flesh factories would resume production, and countless more Imperial guardsmen would be fed into the meat grinder of Vrax, never knowing they were being sacrificed not for the Emperor, but for the advancement of heretical research. As my strength ebbed, I placed the Vox unit among the corpses, camouflaging it as best I could. Perhaps it would be overlooked in the Scions' haste to confirm my elimination. Perhaps some future Imperial force would discover it, the evidence preserved long after those implicated had moved on to new atrocities on other worlds. The chemical fog parted momentarily, allowing a rare glimpse of Vrax sky. No stars were visible through the perpetual haze of pollution and war smoke, just the dull orange glow of distant artillery impacts. I had never seen the actual sky of this world, I realized, never known if it was blue or green or some other color entirely. I had experienced Vrax solely through the filter of war, as had millions before me. The sound of armored boots grew closer. I closed my eyes, conserving my remaining strength for a final act of defiance. There would be no rescue, no recognition of sacrifice, no posthumous honors. On Vrax, there were no heroes, only resources to be expended in the grinding machinery of an endless war. In my final moments of clarity, I understood that Vrax wasn't an aberration but a microcosm of the Imperium itself, a system that consumed human lives by the billions, indifferent to individual suffering, concerned only with perpetuating its own existence. The enemy we fought was a mirror reflecting our own inhumanity back at us, twisted and exaggerated but recognizably derived from the same source. The Scions were close now, their Auspex pings registering my fading life signs among the truly dead. I gripped my las gun, knowing its remaining 2 shots would be meaningless against their carapace armor, but unwilling to die without resistance. In the trenches of Vrax, that small defiance was all that separated us from the corpses we walked upon. No heroes on Vrax, only witnesses to horror, most silenced before they could speak. As darkness closed around me, I hoped that somewhere, somehow, Kask's broadcast had reached someone who would listen, someone who would recognize that the true enemy wasn't just beyond the wire, but within our own ranks. Someone who would understand that the real horror of Vrax wasn't death, but the calculated indifference with which those deaths were ordained. The Vox unit's power cell finally died, cutting off my testimony mid-sentence. In the silence that followed, I heard the Tempestor Prime issuing final approach orders. They had found me, In moments, they would confirm my death and recover any evidence I carried. The truth of Rax would die with me as it had with countless others. My last thought, as I raised my lasgun toward the approaching figures, was not of home or family or even the Emperor. It was of the statistical report that had calculated my expected survival at 23 days. I had lasted 29. 6 days of borrowed time, 6 days to witness horrors never meant to be seen, 6 days to understand that on Vrax, as in the wider Imperium, we were all just meat for the grinder.